Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
Welcome to a very special MIND event. So we came up with the acronym Medicine Informing Novel Discoveries a little while ago because we thought maybe it's time to really talk to the people that are going through the disease that we're talking about instead of just pretending we know as physicians or scientists. And that's where this mind-bending idea came together, that we should really look at the best and brightest opportunities in the community and just say, what do we need to do? In this case, stem cells and precision regenerative medicine and breast cancer. This was actually inspired by T. Denny Sanford. So, you know, Denny Sanford is our relentless donor, and we like relentless, especially when it comes to cancer. This is going to affect 1 in 3 of us, so no one should feel stigmatized. And it's going to affect every one of us in terms of one of our family members or our best friend is going to have it. In the case of breast cancer, that's 300,000 people in this country that are diagnosed annually. And I say people because men can also get breast cancer. But the reason that we decided to have the Sanford Stem Cell Institute that I direct, I'm Katrina Jameson, Kat, is because of Denny. So Denny said, Kat, you seem to have a strong sense of purpose. Where does that come from? And I said, well, for my patients, you know, they think we're going to do a better job, so we better do that. And he goes, okay. Well, my mom died, he said, when I was 4 years old, and nobody should grow up without a mom. So this is specifically for Denny. It's a thank you, Denny. Thank you for everything you've done for us. Thank you to you in the audience for knowing we can change the future. These are the movers and shakers right here on this stage. We've got Sheldon Morris here. So Sheldon Morris directs our Sanford Stem Cell Clinical Center, where regenerative medicines are not just made, they're implemented for the right person at the right time, and that's a precision part. We've got Dr. Sandeep Patel, who never gives up, even if you want him to, he won't. You can't be lazy with Dr. Patel around because he will always find a solution. Niku is a patient advocate, and she's here to tell us about what she's done to conquer cancer for the rest of the community. And Dr. Shatsky, who is the ultimate mover and shaker and just thinks of every opportunity for the one person who's right in front of her. It's never about, oh, well, this is what I do for statistics and just the world in general. It's always about the personal approach to each patient. And I would say that's the ultimate in precision regenerative medicine. So that's a term that refers to having precision diagnostics, and regenerative medicine enhances repair or regeneration of the tissue by targeting cancer stem cells. So I could go on ad nauseum because that's what I like to do, but I would like to just start by introducing Dr. Morris. So Dr. Morris actually got his MPH from Harvard on how to develop clinical trials and also mathematical modeling of epidemic disease spread. At the time, we thought, well, maybe it's not relevant. Epidemics? Well, we've just been through one. But we still have a cancer epidemic. And this is a big challenge for our community. So Sheldon's going to tell us a little bit more about the Sanford Stem Cell Clinical Center. He was doing infectious diseases before we convinced him to come over to the bright side and work with us. And so he will tell you about everything that's going on at the Sanford Stem Cell Clinical Center. Thanks, Sheldon.
Thank you. Thank you, Kat. So I'm sort of the warm-up act here for the main time that folks that are gonna come up later. But what I wanted to get done today is just introduce you, for those that aren't aware so much of the Sanford Stem Cell Institute and the clinical center in particular, because that's what we run and that's where all the clinical trials happen for regenerative medicine. And then I'm gonna hand it off to Dr. Patel, and he'll take us to the next step and sort of ease our way into the idea of cancer and the breast cancer talk. The Institute is like Dr. Jameson had referred to, it is set up largely through philanthropy of Dr. Denny Sanford. We're here to be a global leader in regenerative medicine, and we're sort of like epitomize the bench to bedside concept. We have parts of the Institute are arms that are really working more on discovery, and then making more innovation towards getting to actual translating that into a first in human studies. And that's kind of where I come in, is running our unit so that we try to run the regenerative medicine studies. And I'm going to tell you sort of like what studies we're doing right now. And in particular, I was going to angle this and sort of like how we're impacting women's health as well through some of the studies that we're doing. A big part of that is our Alpha Stem Cell Clinic. Dr. Hamilton is actually the PI for that, which is funded through the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. And we're one of nine different centers in California that are funded through CIRM, and that we try and work together in terms of accelerating regenerative medicine studies. Here's the Institute team leaders. You'll see there's, so we have a lot of great faculty here. There's six different centers. And like I mentioned, there's ones going all the way from discovery. We also have a big sort of push to do exploration in space and how that we can use space as a tool to advance human health and scientific discovery. And we've added this, another program for in the neurosciences. And so we're very excited about expanding into more neurological conditions. And that's sort of one of the highlights that I was going to point out. But first, I was going to tell you sort of what is regenerative medicine, because that might be a question that you might have. I think Dr. Jim Pinoldi kind of alluded to it. But it's sort of a treatment that repairs, replaces, or generates damaged tissues and organs to restore normal function. And we might also add to prevent the loss of normal function as well. And as we see it in terms of what products that we would entertain or try to be have our clinical trials focus on, they can include stem cell therapies, which come in different varieties. I think more and more we're seeing this induced pluripotent stem cell, where you can take a cell and make it into have stem cell properties, and then actually modify that cell, and then you can use that cell for therapies. But there are other types of both autologous coming from yourself. They go take them from somebody, again, modify them and then put them back into that patient. Allogenetic is when you're getting it from another source, maybe a bank where those cells are being propagated and maintained in a very specific way, so they don't change over time, and then they can be used for therapy. And then embryonic we see much less of, but there are still some embryonic cell products out there. Gene therapies, we particularly are interested in gene therapies that are used to modify those stem cells. Sometimes it'd be like something like if you took that cell out, gene therapy applied to it to make it, maybe make, replace a gene that was missing in that person and then put it back into them. So that might work, particularly if that could be done simply with, say, a bone marrow transplant. That might be the easiest way. Cellular therapy is a big part of what we do. I think this is a burgeoning field of chimeric antigen receptor T cells. It's where they can modify an immune cell called a T cell that reacts against a very specific target or antigen that we program it to. And there are already products on the market that are approved, particularly against hematologic malignancies. But now we're using it for all sorts of things. And I'm going to show some of those that in our list of studies. We don't forget small molecules. You stem cell pathways can be targeted with small molecules. If you can do that, that's a lot simpler than having a whole, cellular product being delivered. So if you have a small molecule that can work on those stem cell pathways and block cancers or other diseases, then that is something that we're interested in. And don't forget that we can have devices and diagnostics as well that can look for maybe precancerous changes or in those stem cells and other types of diagnostic tools and imaging to find where those stem cells go. So there's many other sort of things we are involved with. We actually have about 37 trials right now that we're supporting in some fashion. And if you see here that we're a big part of that, it actually still remains cancer because of the CAR-Ts and various other therapies. But something that's really expanded, particularly in the last year or so, has been neurological diseases. And, that's an area where there hasn't been a lot of advances in treatment. And I think you could all agree with that. So that some of these newer technologies may allow us to get at some of these diseases in new ways, and maybe, you know, again, move the needle. This is what we want to do. We want to advance new therapies. And this is the most gratifying piece of being doing what I do, is to try and find new therapies and maybe cure a few things. That would be really what my goal is. But we know we also have done some gene therapies for rare diseases. We're also have got some ID. We have an HIV cure, CAR T therapy. We've done some osteoarthritis. That still is closed now, but it, you know, is another gene therapy study. So there's a lot of expanding sort of portfolio of what we call regenerative medicine. And where does that apply to women's health in particular? I've done actually a lot of sort of women's health studies because I was working in ID, infectious diseases, and in reproductive health. So we've done, you know, diagnostics for women and treatment for like bacterial vaginosis, et cetera. But here, what's really interesting is where regenerative medicine comes to play because of the disparities sometimes we see of women having higher levels of some of these. In particular, I wanted to highlight things like multiple sclerosis, where women are affected 3 to 1. And we just have opened a new study, which I'm going to talk to with the next slide, that targets multiple sclerosis and other diseases as well. We talked about osteoarthritis of the knee. That's, again, 2 times more likely in women. And then that we just finished, we've done all the enrollment that we can do. I don't know if they're going to open up another group. That was very, a lot of interest in that because a lot of people do have that condition as well. And then autoimmune conditions also are also something that is highly represented in women. If you think of lupus, most people that have lupus, for example, are indeed women. And then, of course, there's things such as stress incontinence or, you know, other sort of anatomical issues that happen after menopause. And we have some of the people that we are in our institute that are actually working on this. I mentioned some of the sort of device, I guess this MAFID is a device more, but they're working on extracellular matrix. And in this paper in particular that was published as recently, this is Karen Christman, who helps run one of our institutes, you know, in terms of treating that genitourinary syndrome of menopause. And in on the, what you're looking at, I think on your left-hand side, it was the, actually the genisantan, which was this to modify ILRA1, I believe, was the gene therapy that was applied in that one. So this is the, you know, an example here of, and, you know, one that we're excited about because, again, we're expanding. We've had in the last year, we started a Parkinson's disease study, spinal cord injury study, you know, and now this multiple sclerosis. And it gets to that idea of more of an autoimmune problem. So this product targets CD19, try to modify the background or the, or some of the pathology that's causing multiple sclerosis. And as I alluded to, them, you know, this is more predominantly affecting women. And so right now we're enrolling this one for progressive multiple sclerosis. And if you've had patients with that, you really are looking for some new avenues of treatment. And this hopefully will be one of them. And we have a lot of interest in trying to work with our rheumatologist, gastroenterologist, and trying to bring in this sort of autoimmune target as with CAR T therapies and other ways into our, you know, clinical center. I just wanted to mention this is an example of where we're going away from sort of animal modeling. We can use organoids to test for various diseases. This is some of Dr. Jameson's work where she's created cancer organoids. And, you know, what we've been able to show here, so they, in terms of expression of a target, in this case, ADR1 being expressed with the green. And then with the breast cancer one, this was a very interesting finding that maybe she can talk more to about, but, you know, finding that the hematopoietic stem cells sort of co-locate with those cancer cells. But we've also sent these organoids into space to test new cancer drugs. And that's sort of the long-term goal is, can we use these other systems as a way to both screen for new agents and also, you know, and I think this is the trend also from the FDA that using more organoids rather than animals in their studies. So here's our team. It takes a team. This is the, at least the first, I think, let's see what we've got there. We got 7 space missions there. We've added 2 more since then. So that's what I was just telling Dr. Jameson. We got to update this slide with one that went up just this weekend with SpaceX. So that very exciting part of the Institute as well. But it does tie into this idea of testing for new drugs and being able to find. So now with that, I'm going to transition over to Dr. Patel. I don't know if you need to do introductions.
No,
he's good
no.
to go.
Well, thank you. No, really nice introduction, and just really just shows the power of teamwork, how much we're able to do and go from bench to bedside to the community to space. And so my job is to orient us around some of the clinical trials. And you know, just like the Padres, my job is to help the person batting ahead of me and also the person who's gonna be batting behind me in terms of the kinds of clinical trials that we do. We have a wonderful group and team in the clinical center. And I think it's really important to take a step back that when we go from bench to bedside to these clinical trials that we're talking about, it can take anywhere from 5 to 10 years. And one of the ways we're trying to accelerate these discoveries is through these teams that are formed that have expertise across multiple disciplines. And so you heard about clinical trials in cancer, in neuroscience. And so really this team-based science that cuts across the traditional boundaries we have in departments is really how we move the needle forward. And so the Sanford Cell and Regenerative Medicine Inpatient Service and Komen Outpatient Pavilion Clinic are really a testament to this kind of work. You'll see a patient who has multiple sclerosis, then you may see a patient who has breast cancer, then you may see a patient that has lung cancer. And the California Institutes of Regenerative Medicine fund this through the Alpha Clinic Network. And these are members of our START team. These are the folks who help us get these clinical trials up and running, get these grant proposals up and running, because funding for science is especially important now. And then also in terms of training and education, we have a fellowship where we train multiple different advanced fellows. This in the past year, we trained someone in dermatology, in neurosurgery, and in rheumatology. In the prior year, neuroscience and cancer. It just shows a diversity in the type of specialties and diseases that we're able to train the next generation of regenerative medicine physicians. And so you see many familiar faces up on stage and in the audience. It really does take a village, multiple different specialties, multiple different, not only tumor types, but disease types that are taken care of. Some folks chose a photo maybe a little younger than what they look nowadays, but we don't judge. It really does take a village. We have a wonderful team of APPs as well, and specialize across multiple disease types. I think the fundamental concept that unifies all our talks is really around cancer stem cells. And so we talk about stem cells, we're not talking about cells that are derived from an embryo, but here these are cancer stem-like cells. These are the cells that even after chemotherapy, you think everything's gone, and then the cancer comes back. And so these are not dissimilar from the types of stem cells you have for wound healing and repair or bone marrow regeneration. And so what are some characteristics? And this is from a nice paper Dr. Jameson actually wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine about 2 years ago. Well, one is these cells can divide and make more. This is really good if you have an injury, but if you're cancer, this is actually what you're trying to avoid and get ahead of. Differentiation, these cells, if all they do is become more stem cells, hopefully they don't cause too much harm depending on the type of cell they are. But if they differentiate in other types of cells or unfortunately spread to other locations, this is what we call metastasis. And it's a major problem in what we have to fight in cancer. Quiescence, so oftentimes these stem cells can become dormant and then avoid chemotherapy, avoid radiation, because if they're not dividing, they're not sensitive to our traditional modalities of treatment. And then therapeutic resistance, even our targeted therapies, our immunotherapies, these cells can actually get rid of what's being administered by efflux pumps or just being resistant and hunkering down. These are real problems. And so can we do something to the stem cell niche to allow for these cells to be targeted and so we can cure cancer and other diseases once and for all. One study you're gonna hear more about from Dr. Schatzky is in solid tumors, we've not had the same history with CAR T cell therapy. And the thing about cell therapy is it's a one-off therapy. It's a very intense regimen. But the idea is once you give the T cells, these are living drugs. These are cells that divide in you. They're serial killers. They become memory T cells over time. And if you get a remission, the hope is that your remission is forever. And so can we extrapolate into solid tumors? Can we extrapolate this technology into autoimmune neurologic conditions? This is really the active area, and this is where Dr. Morris was mentioning some of our work. So in solid tumors, we use loss of heterozygosity as kind of a friendly flag, because what happens is with CAR T cells, if you have that target, even on normal cells, let's say mesothelin, Turns out having a low-level expression of that target in the lining of your lung, in the back of your eye, that's all it takes for that cell to attack. And so it's that friendly fire we're trying to avoid. And that's what we can do with some of the novel technologies. And this is really precision medicine. We're looking not only at the patient and the kind of be the match HLA type, we're also looking at the tumor as well, whether the patient has that target. And it's a safety gate for these patients. This is a target across multiple tumors types, including a third of pancreatic cancer, a quarter of lung cancer, breast cancer, about 15%. And so we're seeing this more and more across multiple tumor types. Now, another very active area in cancer research is use of artificial intelligence. And Friends of Cancer Research, which is an organization that federally supports specific cancer projects related to unifying multiple different disease sites, has some really interesting projects in utilizing AI. And so when you talk about a clinical trial, one thing is every time you get a scan, you may have a question, well, how much did my tumor shrink? Who measured my cancer? Is it reliable? And so they have utilized AI-based algorithms to actually standardize measurement of the burden of cancer over time for patients. And this is just their first project. They have multiple other projects in AI and pathology, for example, defining an entity that Dr. Schatzky knows more about called HER2-low or HER2-null disease. And then also actually identifying patients who benefit from antibody drug conjugates, which are a new type of targeted therapy as well. We're actually utilizing AI in clinic at UCSD. Many of our patient visits with patient consent can be done with the AI note taker. And the beauty of this is you get to focus on the patient rather than typing your note. And so it actually allows us to do what we want to do, which is talk to folks rather than being in front of a screen all day. But the screen you may want to be on is, how do you find a clinical trial at UCSD? If you have a friend, a family member, you're trying to find how to take care of them, we have all our trials that Dr. Morris listed earlier available by disease site, right? So you can look, and whether it's Parkinson's disease, whether it's HIV/AIDS, whether it's cystinosis, which is a rare inborn error metabolism, whether it's a specific cancer type, these are all available. And you can also email us, Jameson Languth. He's the leader of our Stanford Stem Cell Institute at j1languth@health.ucsd.edu. And with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Schatzky, who'll be talking about women's health and breast cancer. Thank you.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. You know, I just want to give a little history here. So I am the head of UCSD's Breast Medical Oncology Department, meaning that we give systemic therapies for breast cancer. We have breast surgeons, they're the ones that cut it out. But medical therapies for breast cancer are very important as far as reaching that idea of cure and making people who currently have stage 4 disease live longer and live better lives. And how does that cross over with stem cells? Well, breast cancer has a huge stem cell issue, cancer stem cells. So breast cancer is one of the kind of rare diseases that you can have a tumor in the breast, have surgery, have hormonal therapy, and it can, because of cancer stem cells that were in that original tumor, hide in the body in a dormant state, usually within the bone marrow, and relapse and cause stage 4 or metastatic breast cancer up to 30, maybe even 40 years later. And so breast cancer is really the primary disease of studying these cancer stem cells because we know they exist. We know that surgery alone is not a cure for breast cancer because we've been operating on breast cancer for hundreds of years. It's an ancient disease. We found it in ancient mummies. You can see fungating breast masses there. You know, our famous surgeons that created the Department of Surgery and all of the greatest accomplishments, one of the most famous surgeons in the world, William Halstead, he was known for doing the most aggressive mastectomy surgeries. So he would take out not just the breast, he would take out the fascia, the pectoralis muscles, then he started taking out more and more ribs, and it wasn't curing women of breast cancer because it's not a surgical disease. It's a systemic disease. That original tumor has cells that can leave the primary breast tumor. And that's not because we biopsy them. That's a myth we see on the internet. It's because some cells within a tumor have that ability to leave that breast tumor circulate in the body and hide in the body in a dormant state. And those are the cancer stem cells. We call them disseminated tumor cells. And we've been studying them in breast cancer for a while, but we still haven't made all that much progress. And so while I trained as a breast oncologist, you know, this primary issue of tumor dormancy has always haunted me. And, you know, while I do breast cancer clinical trials in all phases, the idea that we need to have a way that the immune system gets rid of these cells was always center in my mind. And so the crossover between the cell therapies that we do that can train the immune system or change the immune system to get rid of those cells, in addition to treating the cancer and making people live better, is something that's been central to my research goals as an investigator, as a physician scientist forever. So just to share a little bit of the research that has been done so far, you know, I truly believe in the idea that, you know, cancer in its essence is a problem. It's a DNA issue. It comes from our own DNA, our own cells, and they are mutated. And so each person's cancer is entirely unique, and it's as unique as their DNA. So I never treat two patients in clinic the same, because there would be no reason to. They have very different drivers of their cancer. They have very different sensitivities to medicines. And in my clinic, we utilize not just DNA of the cancer, but we utilize the RNA, the protein level, the expression, the response to therapy in real time, and monitoring of the changes in the cancer's DNA as we go along to decide what the best ways to target the cancer, control it, and or cure it are. And so here we have, this was the genomic profile of one of my patients' cancers recently, and it has all of these different mutations with all of these different pathways that the cancer is trying to utilize to grow. And it, by blocking these and not allowing that, we can induce cell death of those cancer cells. They go into what we call their apoptotic pathway. And it's not good enough to just block one way, because then the cancer, it finds another way. It's like a chess game. And so blocking multiple pathways and making sure that that can't happen is my job. And so I use a combination of genomically matched therapy and then targeted therapies. You know, Dr. Morris was talking about some of these oral targeted therapies that are really novel that can do some of this. And then on the more extreme side, when I can manipulate the immune system, we do cellular therapies, we use immunotherapy, but it's all about training the immune system to recognize what it can't see. And it's not about weak immune systems, you know, that's a myth we see on the internet as well. It's not that someone's immune system is weak to let this happen, it's that the cancer's tricky, and it's the cancer has been able to hide itself, and we need to unmask that, and we need to train the immune system to recognize it so that we get long-lasting control. So this was a homegrown project that many of us, Dr. Jameson especially, was involved with me. So this was a monoclonal antibody, a cellular product, a human targeting protein that was developed in the laboratories here at UCSD. It was called sirmtuzumab because it was funded again by the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. That's where that name came from. Very clever. Well, so that was developed in our labs here. And we found first, you know, Dr. Tom Kipps, who works with us frequently, found that this could be really helpful in the disease chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL. And what we started realizing, though, is the target that this goes after, which is called ROR1, is a protein that we call an oncofetal protein, meaning that as a fetus is developing in utero, some of these proteins are expressed, and they're very stem cell-like because they have the pluripotent ability to turn into different organs as the baby needs. It needs to develop its nervous system, its circulatory system, its GI system. And so it expresses proteins that allow the cells to differentiate at the time into that. And when a baby is born, and in human adults especially, these proteins are turned off. They're no longer expressed. However, some cancers co-opt that idea and they start re-expressing these proteins, which makes it an ideal target for drug therapy because these are things that are expressed on cancer cells and not on healthy, normal cells. And so in the laboratory, we started exploring this concept. And we also found a sister protein now. This was the ROR1 story, but we also found a sister protein called ROR2 that we're now really focusing on and is attacking as well, because this protein is expressed on many different nasty solid tumors. It's on breast cancers, pancreatic cancers, colorectal cancers, prostate cancer. And so it's a really ideal target for drug development and for suppression of the ability of these cells to differentiate and spread and divide and survive. So with the help of the Regenerative Medicine Program and the Alpha Clinic and the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, I was able to write a clinical trial using this antibody in combination with the chemotherapy. As you can see here from this graph here, in the laboratory, we saw that when you combined it with the most common chemotherapy given breast cancer, paclitaxel, it suppressed tumor growth much more dramatically. So I was able to write this trial and treat myself 19 different women who had metastatic or advanced stage 4 breast cancer with the antibody. And we were seeing really good results. Some patients on the trial had really durable responses where we dropped the chemo very early and just continued the antibody alone. One of our patients had a durable response of over a year and a half just on the antibody, which had absolutely no toxicity when given alone. So these are slides from one of our patient's tumor samples where you can see high level expression of ROR1 up here, a little bit lower here. These are normal cells, a normal non-ROR expressing tumor type. And we were able to take biopsies for patients on trial, evaluate how much ROR1 was expressed. And now in the next phase of this, when we're looking at ROR2, which seems to be an even better target even maybe than ROR1, or perhaps synergistic the two, we're doing imaging studies even that are injecting patients with dye that enables us to see where in the body these cells might be that express ROR1 and ROR2. And then after they have this imaging study, we then give them drug products that are developed against ROR2 or ROR1 and even conjugated from tiny little chemo molecules that are introduced specifically into the cancer cell. And they only treat that cancer cell, but then they have a neighboring bystander effect where they kill the neighboring cancer cells in addition to that primary tumor, thereby minimizing any kind of toxicity as well, since it's not expressed on the healthy cells. And so, this was one of the first targets. The pharma industry liked our work so much that this antibody was originally bought by a small biotech company called Oncternal, who then, were very entrepreneurial and sold it eventually to another company called Velos Bio, whereas they changed the name of the drug that's now called zilovertamab. If you Google my paper on the subject, it's zilovertamab, even though I really miss sirmtuzumab as a name. And then it was bought and developed into that antibody drug conjugate by the company Merck. So really a homegrown product, just showing what the laboratories and what our programs are doing here to advance the field that is super novel and not done everywhere. This is a scan from one of my patients as far as after about 6 weeks of therapy, a really large tumor here that was in her pelvic area shrunk very dramatically. And that was one of the patients too that had a very long lasting response to this medicine. She unfortunately ended up passing of COVID during the pandemic. So I don't know what would have happened, but it was just such a tragic situation. but these shows how many people in the green were responding to the therapy, with only two who had progressive disease. We are now, as Dr. Patel mentioned briefly, even going into these CAR T cell transcripts in solid tumor patients. And, we've heard stories and been really jealous of solid tumor oncologists for a long time. At the hematologic oncologists, who treat leukemia and lymphoma and myeloproliferative diseases, because they had these amazing advances where they were able to manipulate the immune system using these chimeric T-cell receptors that were specifically designed and caused these long-lasting remissions and cure in patients who were not thought to be curable before from hematologic malignancies. Well, that's not fair. We need some of that in the solid tumor world. But it turns out that solid tumors are a little more complicated in their presentation. A breast cancer tumor, for example, is extremely heterogeneous, which is why it's so difficult to treat. All of the cells there, they can have different levels of expression of things, and they can have a little bit different growth pathways. They're not all homogeneous where I can just do one thing and everything is treated. And so this is a really specific clinical trial that we've been running. And, you know, we've treated our first triple negative breast cancer patient on trial in July of this year. And she's doing very, very well. But this is using the patient's own cancer DNA to match them with this therapy. They have to be a correct match because, again, the idea is to kill the cancer cells and not the healthy cells. And historically, many of these cellular therapies have been, while some are successful, some are really toxic, meaning that we need to keep these patients in the hospital because the risks are so high. You know, we used to quote a 20% death rate of bone marrow transplant because it's, you know, while it can cure some people, there are risks. And these patients can become very immunocompromised. They're at risk for infection. Well, we want to minimize that and bring it into the next generation where it's not so dangerous and these are more easily accessible. And so this trial is really a great example of that because it matches the patient's own DNA that is expressed on their white blood cells and their immune system, and then features of the cancer that make sure that you are only targeting it, and those immune cell attackers are only targeting the cancer cells. So you have to be a very specific match like this, just like a bone marrow transplant. But we basically decrease the normal T cells or decrease the normal lymphocytes that are proliferating in a person's body so that they accept this cellular product that we infuse just like a bag of normal saline. And then those specialized white blood cells, they go and they attack the cancer. And on this trial, which is going in not just our site, but several other sites around the country, we're seeing really impressive things and, but key, very low levels of toxicity. Our patients aren't having tons of seizures. They're not having fevers to 105. They're not getting full body horrific rashes, which was the early generation of cellular therapies. So, you know, overall, very promising for the future. This is the Denali 1 protocol, which is what our CAR T-cell protocol is called. The company's pretty clever. They have an entire protocol of screening where they match the genetically matched cancer and white blood cells called Basecamp. They have this whole big Everest theme. Basecamp screens the patients, then they get matched. And if they're a match for Dr. Patel's side of the trial, then they go on to Everest 1. That's his protocol. And if they match this part of the protocol, they go on to Denali 1. And I think their next, you know, they're going to go for K2. Yeah, like any kind of giant mountain, you know, that they can think of. Kilimanjaro, I don't know. But, it's all about reaching the next level in cancer therapy that is less toxic, more effective, and can do what we never thought was possible before. So, that's enough for me, but now I want to introduce my own beloved patient, Niku Goldrick, and one of my beloved mentors, Dr. Kat Jamieson, to, you know, discuss their journey. And this is the most important part, not what I said.
I can't tell you guys how happy it makes me as a metastatic breast cancer patient to hear this. Okay, big hand for these guys. We are done with science. We're gonna talk about a human story. The story I'm gonna tell you is gonna be in two parts. The sad part gonna be before Dr. Chasky and UCSD. The happy part gonna be after. So you know the two parts. Probably I should get Taylor Swift to write a song about it or something. But so when I was in 2003, I got diagnosed. I had a clear mammogram, feeling great. Just happened. My wonderful doctor found a lymph node, she thought, ended up to be a 0.9 centimeter. For those of you that speak metric, you know how small that is. At that time, they really didn't know much about lobular breast cancer and what a tricky disease that was. I got treated at Yale New Haven. I was living in Connecticut then. All the standard treatment, they told me you're cured, you're good. Two young boys, I was just so happy to get out of there. Fast forward to 2002, 3 years ago, I started having a lot of GI issues. I was getting care north of here. I won't mention doctors or hospitals or anything, but it was north of here. So, and everybody started just ignoring it. My care team, my oncologist, everybody, they said, oh, is irritable bowel syndrome. You're fine. You had clear colonoscopy, clear endoscopy. They did a couple of scans. Nothing showed up. It was, they just call it, you know, you're fine. Come back in 6 months. Well, as my husband of 45 years could tell, I'm an incredibly stubborn person. So I practically checked myself to a different hospital and I said, I have this severe abdominal pain, open me up. And they did, you know, just you go to emergency room and complain enough. And sure enough, my cancer of 19 years earlier was all over my peritoneum. It had come back. I had a metastatic disease. Cancer, for those of you who are cancer survivors, cancer thrivers, you know that cancer robs people of control. At that moment in time, everything I knew about my life was gone. And I had to gain some of that control back. And the way I could do it was by knowledge, by activism, by getting trained, by going out there and helping other people that were going through what I was going through. I wanted to be part of a team. I wanted to be at that table where decisions are made about my health. Jim and I went in and sat with my oncologist at that time, and I had all these questions. I've done all this research, and her comment was, oh, you are one of those patients. Yes, I'm one of those patients. And I already knew I was with the wrong team. So again, by then I was trained. I knew who are the top leading oncologists in my cancer in the country. And guess what? She was right there. So I came to San Diego to get a second opinion. And at that time, she wasn't taking new patients. So I came in ready to beg, to buy her whatever her favorite cookies, whatever it takes, babysit her children, whatever. I started stalking her on like, you know, Twitter account. I'm like, okay, what does she like? You know, I was so desperate. I'm like, I want her. I want her to like me, to take me, to work with me. So I came in, and guess what? We just somehow bonded on our first, you know, get together. Jim came with me and we talked, and it was such a light, such brightness to understand somebody that understood my disease and asked my opinion and talked to me, and I was at the table. And so that's a happy story now. I am right now enrolled in a clinical trial, not the stage these brilliant people are speaking, but I will get there. She promised me, but I'm on a clinical trial right now, fourth month, doing pretty well. And my always voice has been for the past 3 years since metastatic diagnosis is that sit at a table. As a patient, we have to sit at the table and be part of the team. We have to be heard. That's all I have to say. These are the brilliant.
Thank you so much, Siku. So, so you can see cancer is relentless, and so are we, right? So are we together. Niku was telling me that her name means beautiful soul, and you can see the light shining out of Niku's eyes, right? That's what we need. So, you know, we welcome everyone to be at the table with us as we develop the next precision set of diagnostic strategies and therapies. You know, I was looking around this museum. It's a pretty remarkable museum. It makes me hopeful every time I'm here. And I looked up the stairs. If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor, Nelson Mandela. None of us are neutral in the face of injustice when it comes to cancer. It's an unjust disease. We can't let this rob our lives, our families, of vitality? No. We're saying no today, right? And we're saying yes to new research that will lead to actual cures. We never want cancer to come back. We want it to be the little C. And what we learned from Dr. Morris, Dr. Patel, Niku, and Dr. Shatsky is cancer is sneaky. It can clone itself, and it can evade the immune system, and we want to stop both those properties. We're making drugs in real time that do that. They could be small molecules, monoclonal antibodies, trastuzumab, cellular therapeutics, as we heard with Dr. Patel leading the charge on our inpatient service. These are all new things. And the real threat to all of us is therapeutic nihilism. It's, oh no, that sounds too hard. Oh, that sounds too difficult. That sounds impossible. But no, it isn't, apparently, Niku, right? Dr. Shatsky, Dr. Patel, Dr. Morris? No? This is Mission Impossible right here. So if you have the music, here you go. It's not impossible though, as you know. And we don't have Tom Cruise, but we need him to now come parachuting in. So anyway, I wanted to open up to questions from the audience, but also ask individual questions just to put everybody on the spot here because it's fun. I also wanted to thank Catherine Canjo for allowing us to be in this beautiful place. She always reminds us that we have to think differently about what look like really tough problems, but maybe they're not as tough when we work together. We've got Mateo, Maricar, members of our team here, Michelle Pius. Yes, we do need to go for more walks. We're getting out of shape. But anyway, this is our community. So Dr. Morris, we talk about all these erudite clinical trials. How do we know when they're working? I mean, you're a biostatistician. You always hold us our feet to the fire when it comes to statistical analysis. How are we going to see going forward whether or not we have somebody on the right trial? How are we going to determine that when people have so many choices?
Well, you know, I was thinking, you know, when you said, how do we know when things are working? I mean, obviously we have to do those studies and have good outcomes and good ways to measure things. I think one of the things that we are trying to develop is, that newer tools to actually measure the effect that the cancer has gone away. Or ways to measure the outcomes. I think traditionally, of course, you're looking at outcomes such as progression-free survival and mortality things. But you know, if we have better tools to actually detect cancers earlier, such as pre-cancer, and maybe we can intervene earlier before people even get cancer. In terms of the who's to choose to what study to go on. Well, I think you have to see what's around. You should really. I want to echo sort of that being that your own advocate as a patient, because every doctor you see they only know so much. So sometimes you need to do your own research, look what other trials are around, talk to your physician, get other opinions, and before you decide on what you want to do. Sometimes the best option is a clinical trial. And there are hopefully more and more trials that are going to be available for people, and that's the only way we're going to learn and to develop these new therapies.
Yeah, so we have a stellar health initiative we're trying to start right now, where people will have whole body MRIs, whole genome sequencing, single cell RNA sequencing on their stem cells, both in their blood and in the cancer. So that's something we're thinking of starting. Who would be interested in something like that? Yes. So we would do this as if we're planning it, believe it or not, on astronauts. You heard Dr. Morris mention this. The person who's also really interested in helping us with this is Judy Faulkner, who founded EPIC. So if anybody has been on EPIC, most of us are, as patients, we're all, every one of us is going to be a patient. She has a Cosmos research portal and wants to make those results available to patients as research subjects return of results. So that's the next endeavor. Dr. Patel, you attend on this inpatient cell and regenerative medicine service. It's a little unusual. You mentioned solid tumors. We don't usually think of CAR T cells or cellular therapies in general. Do you think this is going to become standard of care, or what are your thoughts? Because we know that there's some toxicity. How do we diminish that, and how do we lead the way forward? Are you specifically? We call it the Patel program because 50% of the trials are Dr. Patel.
I think it's the alliteration, I think, mainly.
Yeah, that too.
But it's a great question, Dr. Jameson. So a couple of these cell therapies are now FDA-approved standard of care treatments. So there's a type of treatment in melanoma Dr. Greg Daniels led called tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte therapy. What you do is you have a little surgery. You cut out the tumor, you take all the immune cells, and you kind of put them through boot camp outside of the body, and you grow them, and you grow them, and you actually make them in a personalized cell product. This is now an FDA-approved therapy. It's something we offer. We actually have a patient about to get treated later this month with this therapy, and it's a product made from them for them. There's also for synovial sarcoma, which is a sarcoma really devastating in younger patients. We have a cell therapy there that was a clinical trial. And now it's FDA approved in solid tumors as well. And so the way we do this is working with the disease experts, making sure there's expertise not only in the disease, but also in giving the cellular therapeutic as well. And then now we have all sorts of other therapies, bispecific T cell engagers, small molecule inhibitors that activate the immune response, even injecting the pancreas directly with an inflammatory agent, right, with an electroporating gun during surgery. And so all these have the potential for these types of side effects that the folks on stage, including all of us, manage when we're on the service.
Thank you very much, Dr. Patel. So Niku, you were mentioning you have to be at the table, otherwise you're on the menu. As a patient, you have to be able to advocate for yourself, but how do you advocate for others? Can you go to the FDA? Can you go to these funding agencies and say, please stop cutting funding for science? I'm doing a selfless plug.
some of the things are pretty simple. I'm just going to talk about lobular breast cancer. If anyone in this room knows Governor Newsom, I submitted, and two other people, we submitted a request to him a week ago to declare October 15th lobular breast cancer day.
Wow.
And the only reason we did that is because when it comes up, I know it's a headline, but that headline turns into information. That turns into patients saying, oh, that's what I have. Oh, these are the questions I should ask. So we could do something little, as simple as I write a letter, Governor Newsom, I'm not your best friend, but please do this for us, And we have some of the top researchers in the country right here in the state, And so it starts with little steps, and it has a much bigger effect. And also I think more times, more organizations that I work with, just as more patients are informed that, yes, they can ask a question, they can be part of the conversation about the treatment, so forth, that grows, They keep paying it forward.
So speaking of paying it forward, we have a lot of people in the audience that want to ask questions. But Dr. Shansky, how do we prevent ourselves from becoming lazy and think we've got enough therapies? What keeps you going to keep doing this?
Yeah, my patients, and that is a really big downfall of a lot of the way that I think the health system has functioned to, doctors are somehow losing that. And that's definitely not something that I don't think I could ever lose. I wake up in the morning and I tell my patients this every day in clinic, I am here and I get up in the morning because I want to see this. I want to see you doing better. I want to see you feeling better. I want to see that our therapies are working. And I mean, that's really what drives me. But I try to teach that as a professor at the university to our younger generations of physicians and scientists, because they need that. They need to know that they're here because of a person. And that person could be their mom. It could be their sister. It could be their brother. And they need to treat every single person like they are their family. How do you want to be treated? You know, that's how we go about patient care. We engage our patients, we listen to them, and, you know, we talk about what's possible and what's not, but we partner with them on all of this. And teaching the younger generation of physicians is really important to me as well, because I see that waning in medicine. I'm lucky enough to come from where my father was a physician, and I sort of was ingrained in that way at a very young age. But, you know, what I took away from what my father taught me was his bedside manner. That was the most important thing of healing to me, is how he interacted with patients, how he could make them laugh, how they didn't come away from their appointment feeling worse, no matter what was shared. And so the art of medicine and the science of medicine need to intertwine. And that is why I get up in the morning and do this.
It seems appropriate. You're in a museum of contemporary art. So thank you so much, Dr. Shatsky. You can see it's a calling. It's not a job. This is what she was meant to do. And I would say the same for Dr. Patel, Dr. Morrison, and Niku, you're a star. So we've got to bring you back for more of these. We did want to open this up for question before the sun sets on our spectacular event here. Did anybody have any questions from the audience? Yes, please go ahead.
Dr. Shatsky, how do you... or when do you incorporate regenerative medicine? Is it at first diagnosis, or is it on recurrence, or is it, you know, at what point are you guys bringing it in?
Well, so I am very into analyzing each patient and their cancer very uniquely. I don't, you know, if the pathology report isn't telling me what I need to know, I go and I order more studies. I investigate that cancer to the highest level so that I can understand it and provide the patient with a more personalized treatment option. Many may, you know, say, well, in the curative setting, you can't do that, but that's not the case at all. I think that a lot of breast cancer cases, even in the curative setting, are treated wrong and they're not leading to cures. And so I want to know about the tumor biology. I incorporate all of the different, you know, aspects of this research into the most early stage of patient care. And then as, you know, we give therapies, we monitor that response. You know, Dr. Morris was kind of alluding to the ways that we can monitor things at the most molecular level these days, as far as recurrence, and potentially intervene way before things have gone south. But, you know, in no matter if I'm treating a stage zero breast cancer patient or a stage four breast cancer patient, you know, we need to be utilizing all of the things that are available to us as tools and not doing things the same way that they have been done for the past 60 years.
Precision.
Exactly.
Precision, yeah. And that's why we were alluding to Stellar Health. So if you have your own personal history of cancer, or you have a family history of cancer, we want to make that available to everyone. So that's where we want to get at cancer before it even has a chance to gain hold. And that's our initiative we hope to launch. And the next time we have a mind event, maybe we'll have made more inroads, but that's how we can move ahead on this. Any other questions? Yes, Dr. Kent.
Yeah, thanks for a great description of what we're doing at the Regenerative Center. I know that one of the ways we go about looking for targets is by looking for the receptors. Another way is by comparing DNA. Now that we have a spy, Ezra Cohn, at Tempest, the question is, how do we use the RNA to help diagnose and find the specific treatments for particular cancers?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take this from breast cancer and then you go for others, but you know, I'm highly interested in the RNA reports that Tempest is providing us, and I think that information is just as important as the DNA for all of my patients. You know, I'm lucky that I do utilize that company very, very frequently, but I look at the DNA report, and then I look at the RNA expression level, and I can see that way what pathways, and they're often the worst players. They're the ones that we know are bad things, and seeing that those are overexpressed in the pathway, I can utilize therapies that are not approved in breast cancer. And I do that frequently. I can use off-label therapies to target what needs to be targeted in that cancer. It's not that I believe completely in a tumor agnostic approach, meaning that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're, because I do think that tumor-specific specialty is beneficial for knowing the what happens to the patient and knowing about that. But as far as the RNA expression, I think that's super important so that I can target the pathway. You know, it's not all about a single gene mutation. It's an entirely overexpressed variety of pathways. And, you know, they've really done better in this in the hematologic malignancy world where you can't use just one thing when there's five pathways expressed. You have to utilize, you know, multi-drug therapies and think about all of those to block the cancer growth. I think when I was training once, I was in the lab of Dennis Slamon, who is a very famous oncologist. He's still the chief of UCLA hematology oncology, but he was talking to us in the lab one day, and he was talking about a ship or a rowboat, how about I put it this way, in the river, and the rowboat has a leak, and then the rowboat has like five leaks, and you have water spurting up. Well, I can't just plug one of those. I need to attack all of them. And so by looking at, you know, the genomics and the RNA and all of that, I can block all of the pathways that the cancer is utilizing to grow, so I can stop cell growth, direct it to its death pathway, but also prevent it from easily developing resistance, which is a huge issue when you're treating cancer. It's just like bacteria. You give it one therapy, it becomes resistant. It finds a way. So playing that chess game with the cancer is really important, and these technologies allow us to do that.
Yeah, and for people who are maybe thinking, what's DNA, what's RNA, what's protein? If you think of DNA as a blueprint for your house when you're going to have a remodel, don't do it. It'll take 2 years when you think it's going to be 2 months. But DNA is the architect's blueprint for the cell. RNA is what the engineer decided to put in as a retaining wall or post. And then protein is the builder. The builder may have used different material, and all three DNA, RNA, and protein can go awry in cancer. And now we have the technology to look at that, Jerry, as you know, as a scientist. It's no longer a mystery. We can look at the real disease instead of trying to make a caricature. And I think the FDA has made some bold moves this year in a very good way. They're going with RNA, but they're also going with detection of changes in RNA, not just DNA. And they're getting very precise about molecular aspects of tumor growth. We can see it, we can target it. We just need to do it more and make it part of the standard of care. We should all demand it.
Yeah.
You know, we shouldn't just say, oh, well, good enough. No, in cancer, good enough is not good enough. It has to be great. Right, Robbie?
Absolutely.
Right, you're a very precise dentist. Just good enough is not good enough. It has to be perfect, and this is we know that cancer takes a highway sometimes, and we've talked about this, ADAR1 is one of those highways. We can block it. But there's so many other things we can do together, and I think this is really on us. This is throwing down the gauntlet, right, Nico?
Yeah, absolutely. So proud of you.
Well, we're proud of you. Does anybody else have another question before we go out for sunset drinks? Yes, Ruby.
Early diagnosis, like in younger women, are there any blood works that we could find tumor markers?
Yeah, good question.
As a standard of care, let's start them in their 20s and in their 30s, and let's catch this way earlier before we have metastasis.
Yeah. Do you mean pre-diagnosis or after diagnosis?
Pre-diagnosis as...
Yeah, so difficult
screening,
because...
Yeah.
When we talk about, like, for example, genes that people have been born with, we can certainly go and test for that. But there's so much there that we're missing as far as why a person develops cancer. The majority of women do not have a family history of breast cancer. That's another myth that's out there, that you have to have a family history. Almost no one does. That's not that common. I mean, and most women don't have a single gene that is broken that we test for and they say, okay, that person's really high risk. What we're learning more and more is there's probably much more that we need to discover about what's called polygenic risk, meaning that maybe you have 15 genes that are slightly twisted in the wrong direction that allowed one mutation to escape your immune surveillance. As far as where we at about, you know, detecting that way earlier, there's a long way to go. We are looking at the most, you know, precise levels of detecting single units of molecular, you know, single units of cancer DNA down to, you know, the picomolar and nanomolar level. And our tests are getting more and more specific and more sensitive. But as you get more sensitive, it's hard to filter out the junk from what the cancer is and what is going to be filtered out by your immune system naturally, because we all make cancer cells every day. Our cells replicate billions of times. And it's usually thrown out, like identified immediately, like, ah, that's a bad cell, get rid of them. You know, sort of like a conveyor line. You get rid of the bad products. They're broken. But that doesn't always happen. And so as our technology gets more sensitive, it's hard to filter out what's going to be gotten rid of already versus what's going to cause a problem. And that's where we really need to focus that differentiation place before you see a gross tumor, before things have gone south enough, and get the immune system involved to put a flag on it. Because that's what we normally do with cancer cells. We flag them and we kill them. And very sneaky mutations, they can get away with evading it. They have developed ways to mask themselves.
Good news is we live in the land of alumina, the land yeah, of Thermo exactly. Fisher, right, Patrick?
Technology.
The land where these technologies are actually invented and mastered, I would say. We live in an unusual town where everybody works together. We've got Jessica Pham back here as our stellar mission specialist. We realize cancer can grow faster in space because of Peggy Whitson making the original observation. NASA's a partner, NSF, National Cancer Institute, California Institute for Regenerative Medicine has over $3 billion left to spend. Please tell them you need it for cancer research and to not stop at just cell and gene therapy. You have a voice, as Niku was saying, and we have a stronger voice together. So thank you for being here. We really appreciate everybody speaking in unison to say this matters. And for our participants, Dr. Shasky, Niku.
I thought you would say, but she didn't. I want you all to know that she is a renowned author. And she is so humble. She and her husband write their top winner fiction writers. And so this one is not just a patient advocate, she's not just a patient, she's very famous and a brilliant, brilliant writer.
As you could tell, there is a fan club here.
Yeah. I'm a fan. Yeah, yeah. I'm a huge fan.
Yes. And I'm a fan.
Well, we'll end on that. If she wasn't going to say it, I had to.
Yeah. Well, we're all fans of each other here. Thank you so much for being here. It really helps to sharpen our focus. And we hope you enjoy the drinks outside.